Hi, this is Sarah Peterson.
And I'm Emily J. Smith.
And this is our podcast, Clean Countertops, where we interrogate ideals of womanhood. We have a guest that we're super excited about. It's Emily Adrian. She is an author. Her recent book is called Seduction Theory. And as soon as I read it, I texted Emily about it because it just is so, so juicy in terms of how we think of aspirational women, perfect women.
Perfect women, but complex, you know.
Yes.
Perfect presenting, but deeply flawed and complex women. I mean, we had so many questions. Yeah. It's a brilliant book. And we're very excited to talk to Emily.
Emily Adrian, we're so happy to see you and talk to you about your book.
Thanks for having me.
It's amazing to meet you. Sarah read Seduction Theory, your latest novel, and immediately texted me, Emily, you have to read this. We need to discuss immediately. And actually, I was on my way to see Sarah, and I devoured it in the five-hour car ride on audio. And then I had a few hours left, I think, on the way back, and I finished it, and then immediately bought the hard copy and read it in physical form. Because I'm like, I need these sentences in my hands. They're so good.
I hear from a lot of people who listen to it on audiobook. And is it confusing that way? It seems like it would be. No? She does a good job.
I was so just engulfed in the whole thing. Like, I was like, I love Sarah and a five-hour drive is long. But I was like, actually, I don't want this to end. So
yeah, I can see how it'd be confusing too, just because of the way the book is structured, obviously.
Yeah.
Emily, so we talk about ideals of womanhood, obviously, on this podcast. And could you give listeners a general, like very bare bones synopsis of what the book is about, just sort of as an entry point to the discussion?
Yeah. So it's about a sort of power academic couple, academic power couple.
Yep.
Whose extramarital affairs are fictionalized in a graduate student's thesis, which she then submits to this same couple because they are advising the thesis and sort of sits back and waits for their lives to implode.
Oh my God, it's so good. It's so good. The whole setup is just so delicious.
So good.
My first question is how you conceived of the character of Simone. I mean, there's three central characters, but she's one half of the power academic couple. And she's just, for me, a very aspirational figure in that she seems to live entirely for herself according to her own, like, moral code, her own desires, her own perception of life. And I don't know, she just seems like somebody who can't really exist, but like I like to believe she can. So I'm just curious how you even started characterizing her.
I've never heard anybody say that about her. Simone as an aspirational character may reveal more about yourself, Sarah, than you mean it to.
No, that is 100% correct. 100% correct. Okay, I will say her not being a mother, there is a freedom to her that I think is intrinsically connected to her not being a mother, at least for me reading it.
Yeah, well, for sure. I mean, I think we should come back to that question because so we have a deeply unreliable narrator. And so I think one question that you have to ask is how much of Robbie, the graduate student's portrayal of Simone, is actually accurate. And I think there's even a question of whether Simone, in fact, does not have kids.
Oh,
wow.
There's some weird narrative instability.
Holy shit.
Because I think that in real life, I think this woman probably does have, in real life, none of it's real. But in a more, let's say, in a story of her life that was more committed to realism, I think she probably would have at least one child.
That is blowing my mind. That's so interesting. Okay.
And I think that the graduate student who is intent on sort of using her MFA thesis as an opportunity to expose her professors maybe can't really wrap her head around, one, what it would mean to be a mother, or two, you know, what it would mean to choose not to be a mother. Like, she's just not even really going to go there either way, I think. So no matter how you read, you know, the reality of Simone's situation, I think that there is sort of an intentional lack of depth when we talk about her as a mother or as a non-mother, because our narrator is just like, I got nothing.
Okay, no, that's such a good point. And then I'm going to let you, Emily Smith, go next. But I just need to follow through on the lack of depth. It did strike me in the way her beauty is characterized in almost all of the versions, because there's several versions of Simone in the book.
Yeah.
It's impossible to think about her without thinking about her beauty as like a foundational characteristic. So, yeah. I don't know. I just thought that was really interesting in terms of when we think ideal woman, like obviously physical beauty is part of that.
Yeah, she's so ideal. I mean, I found Simone aspirational a lot too, even though she's such, when we were coming up with questions for this, it's just like you walked such a nice, fine balance of a kind of brutal character, but still so compelling, you know? And it's really interesting to hear how you're thinking about this character through the eyes of the narrator being deeply unreliable. The detail that stays in my mind is like an under 6 minute mile. is that real?
So I had to like think long and hard about exactly how fast her mile should be. So right, I'm very glad you brought that up, because not everybody cares. I care.
I care.
Because everybody runs at a different pace, and that's okay. But
brave.
But we also,
okay. Yeah. On this podcast, very okay.
We also all have a different understanding of what a really impressive mile would be. So I think for like at most women around Simone's age, running under a 7 minute mile is like, it's tough. Like, lots of women can do it. It's not going to make you like an elite athlete. You're not necessarily going to qualify for Boston just because you can run that 1 mile. But it's, I think it's enough for most people to be impressed, but not everybody, and maybe not this 23-year-old. So I had to make it like as fast as fucking possible.
That's, it was amazing. That was when the veneer started to crack a little for me. So that's cool. Yeah. Okay. I had a question. We might bounce around a lot because Sarah and I were like thinking about these questions. So Ethan's infatuation with Simone, his love for her, he's like so adoring of her. She is this, you know, again, through the eyes of the narrator, but it's rare. It's rare in a hetero relationship for the man to be so adoring of his, like in a deep, respectful way. Mm-hmm. And his infidelity is almost like, and out to that, because he doesn't choose another like elevated woman. He chooses someone he feels like deeply comfortable and is kind of, I mean, the knees as like crinkled baby faces or something when you're describing Abigail's, I died.
But if we're thinking about Robbie as describing the knees, that makes
young
so
woman
much sense.
Describing, totally.
Yeah, like merciless.
I put a quote here. The more I love you, he says about Simone, the more I hate myself. And I do find that's so real with men who like revere women. There's something like something that kind of festers in them. And so my question is can a man ever thoroughly revere his partner without some repercussions, like in this case, an infidelity? Like, is it always festering because of this sexist society we live in? Were you trying to comment on that? Talk to me about their relationship a little bit.
Well, I mean, he does say that after having cheated on her, right? I think that that's,
okay.
He's saying
in
reaction to, he hates himself because he messed up and he betrayed her.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
I don't think he ever explicitly admits, or I don't think Robbie admits on Ethan's behalf that you know, his love for Simone actually like sort of lowers his own self-esteem. But I do think like your point that when he does go to have an affair, he chooses somebody who's not, you know, notably beautiful, who has certain things in common with him that Simone never shared. Somebody that he is like, he's not even like totally sure that he's attracted to her. He's sort of negotiating his own attraction as he prepares to like do this thing behind his wife's back. And, you know, I think that one of, like, the pressures that Ethan is caving under is not just his own love for his wife and maybe, you know, feelings of inferiority, but the pressure of everybody sharing that opinion. You know, like everybody's looking at them and knowing that, one, he's the spousal hire, so he doesn't have the same professional status that she has. He's, you know, not as revered by their students. He's not as much of a sort of celebrity on campus. His work has been forgotten at this point. He hasn't published a novel since his 20s. And so in a way, I think one of the things that they're sort of continually coming up against is not how they feel about each other, but how they feel about how everybody else feels about them.
Mm-hmm.
And so he is almost like following a script that somebody else wrote for him. He's like, you know what? I need to like get on her level. I need to, you know, I need to do something that she has not done to me. I need to level the playing field. And he goes off and does this thing without really even knowing why. And when he regrets it, I think it's because he almost wasn't acting on his own motivations.
Yeah, it's an interesting balance. And this relates to a question you were going to ask, Sarah, because it's so true. Their interactions, like their love is clear. They love talking to each other.
Yeah, that was something. I do want to talk about that. Okay, so they get together super young. And yeah, they have incredible sex and an incredible intellectual connection and an incredible emotional connection. And I was, I don't know, I was like, does that exist? And why would Robbie, I don't know, glamorize that? I don't know. I thought that was really interesting because like, it did feel just like too good to be true. I think there was a line where it's like, she tried to think of things that she found obnoxious. And then she like says something and she says, but no. Like what? Like, I was dying over that. So yeah, how did you think about, I don't know, heteroromantic love and the sustainability of it and the romance of it?
So that was kind of like really the origin story of the book is I was reading a lot of, you know, marriage discourse, divorce discourse, memoirs and autofictions about non-monogamy or open marriages or leaving your husband or whatever. A lot of it is really good. It's very zeitgeisty. It's very popular right now. And almost all of it is really, really not romantic. Like a lot of it is very sort of political or social or like it comes down to how, you know, we organize our lives around like shared domestic responsibilities and parenting and shared bank accounts and all of these things. And it's about sex often, but it's not usually about love just on its own terms. It's not usually most of the conversations that we have around marriage, I think, kind of leave behind the problem that inspires us to get married often in the first place, which is just like you fall in love with this person and you're possessive of them and you want to be with them and you don't want anyone else to be with them and you just lock that shit down because it's emotional.
Right.
Yeah. Really.
And we tell ourselves all kinds of things about like why we get married and then we tell ourselves different things about why we're still married. But I wanted to like bring it back to that first, I guess, spark of passion that lands most people in a situation where they're having these conversations at all. And so the question of why Robbie is writing about their marriage in these terms is interesting. And I actually think that it's maybe a weakness in the book that it's not really clear. I don't know if it's a weakness in the book, but it's
yeah, I'm like, no, it's not.
Yeah. Never mind.
There's a lot of things where you can see Robbie's perspective sort of warping the narrative and you can explain why she's motivated to write what she is writing. And then there are times when I think as the writer, I am asking you to take, you know, the novel that Robbie has written at face value on its own terms and read, you know, Ethan and Simone as real people who are involved in this very real love story. And I can think of reasons why Robbie would do that herself. I mean, I think she doesn't get it. Like she is confused about why Simone isn't willing to just sort of like abandon her marriage and have sex with her students and fulfill Robbie's fantasies. And so, you know, as novelists do, she's trying to write her way through it. She's like, well, what would it look like? How might it feel to be in this marriage? But I also just wanted to write about a long-term marriage where there are problems and they are under pressure. But the real problem is that they love each other and they want to be together. They don't want to escape the marriage. They want it to last. That was just more interesting to me as a problem. And honestly, I've been married for a long time. I got married really young, as they did. And I like still, I'm a wife guy, but the other way around. If I try to think of things that I like don't like about my husband, I don't get very far. If I try to think about why it is sort of challenging to balance like a really deep emotional romantic bond with him, with everything else I'm up against in my life, like I have a lot to say.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. That's really interesting. And it's related to what you said about the question I asked. Like, that makes it very clear. It's like the societal pressure on them in this society where men are the achievers or are supposed to be a certain way, and how that affects, like, church. Yeah.
Yeah.
Makes things crack. There's this line where Robbie is talking to Simone and she says something like, I don't know the line, but essentially seduction and challenge are the same thing, which is very compelling to me. I relate to that. And, you know, under that premise, which we can decide whether or not it's true or not, but I'm wondering, like, can Simone be seduced? Simone is not seduced by Robbie despite her attempts and desires. Ethan is more of a very foundational space for her. Like, her seduction is almost with herself, in a sense. And I'm just wondering, yeah, where you land on that question, like Simone's relationship to seduction.
And to Simone.
Yeah.
I think Simone is sort of constantly trying to strike the right balance between power and vulnerability. Like, she knows that as a, you know, a woman who's very beautiful and who has all of these sort of celebrated professional accomplishments and whose students revere her, she knows she has a lot of just, like, straight up traditional power. And I think Robbie admits at some point that there is an amount of power that Simone would have and a certain amount of respect that people would grant her, even if she was ugly. Like, even if she was just, you know, like that aging professor wearing, like, the linen pants and the shapeless blouse and showing up with, like, her gray hair and her glasses, like, people would still be like, okay, she is the best writer in the department and she has, you know, won these awards and every, like, people would still care. But on top of all of that, she is very beautiful, and Simone knows that and wields it accordingly. And then at the same time, I think she knows that one way to sort of maximize her influence as a woman is to also wield vulnerability. So, like, she makes sure everybody knows that she is an orphan. Her mom died a long time ago. She is sort of, like, selectively dole out little personal things that make her seem, you know, less powerful than she is. And I think maybe the answer is no, she can't be seduced, because she knows that to be seduced would be to go all the way into the vulnerable side of this equation. Yeah.
Totally.
So can we talk about the nature of infidelity? Because there are two very different forms in the book. And of course, we have the unreliable narrator. But I think in all versions, one form feels like self-sabotage and another feels, I don't know, real. Like, in a way where, yes, Simone is not seduced, but she is not being faithful. You know what I mean?
No, yeah.
So, yeah, did you do that really deliberately, like, find, you know, a sexual form of infidelity that was not, like, spiritually unfaithful? You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Ethan really just has this one night stand with somebody, and Simone takes it really, really hard. Meanwhile, she is sort of having, like, a really intense emotional affair where she's using Robbie to sort of validate and titillate herself at every moment. And I think what Robbie senses, and maybe never fully articulates, but what she's really trying to prove in her thesis is that what Simone did is worse. Like, it is a more thorough betrayal, and it's more intentional, and it was sort of obsessively maintained, and it was also never confessed.
Totally. Yeah, which is huge. And she's the victim of Simone trying to maintain her innocence. Like, in this situation where she's like, okay, I need to, like, play the innocent role and thus disregard Robbie as any, like, disregard any trace of my relationship with Robbie. Yeah. And that's brutal. I mean, there's so much that's more villainous about Simone's approach, which is really interesting, even though it's so much grayer. And that is very gendered. It seems kind of like the way it would play out in a hetero relationship, right? Or
I don't know. I think men and women are both really susceptible to pushing the boundaries of emotional intimacy and sort of trying to get what they want from other people without crossing any lines that can really, like, cost them anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. I always assume women are smarter in that capacity.
Well,
like,
yeah.
They can maneuver better.
That's
men are
true.
Just like, I mean, oh, shit, I took my dick yeah. out or something.
Like. Well, right. And insofar as Simone gets away with it, that is gendered, I think. And I think Ethan, right. you know, might have done that if he had the nuance and right. the grace to do
mm-hmm.
it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So I know you said that Simone might well be a mother, but that being said, this book is not really about motherhood. I mean, Abigail is a mother, and those scenes I thought were hilarious. But as a mom, I find myself, A, not wanting to read fiction that's like about motherhood with a capital M. Like, I yeah. find books like this so deeply pleasurable because it just taps into, I don't know, it just taps into a part of me that feels like free from the domestic pulls of life. And I don't know, do you feel that when writing books like this?
I mean, I like writing about motherhood and about sort of like the domestic chaos in which motherhood is accomplished. I guess what I would say is that I think motherhood is like a very stealthy theme in this book. I mean, you have both sort of touched on this a little bit, but one of the things that's different between Abigail, the woman with whom Ethan has the one-night stand, and Simone is that Abigail's a mom and Simone is not. And Ethan uses this difference between them twice in really manipulative ways. The first time he's talking to Simone about Abigail, and he's almost like flirting with like confessing that he has feelings yeah. for somebody. And instead he's just like, oh yeah, I'm becoming friends with the secretary. And right. she's like, cool.
Yeah. yeah. So good. So good.
And he's like, yeah, she's kind of weird though. Like there's something kind of immature about her, as if like once you have a kid, you stop developing
right.
you know, as an individual. And Simone's like, fuck you. That's an insane thing to say about a woman. And Ethan's like caught off guard by this because he didn't know that Simone would have a sort of like feminist reaction to this.
Right, right.
And then when he's actually seducing Abigail on the night that they hook up, he says the opposite thing about his wife. He says, you know what? I love her, but she is a little bit immature. It's like, if you don't have kids, then you stop developing. And that time it works. Like he figures out how to take
yeah.
this weird insult and make it work, because now this time he's talking to a mom who doesn't like Simone, and she's like, that's right.
Wow. Exactly. Yeah, that's so brilliant.
I think the theme that kind of crops up in the book is like, how does women's status as moms or as not moms sort of affect the way people see them and what we feel, in what ways they are more respected and in what ways they're less respected.
Totally. Like, back to your knee comment, the description of the knees. Like, there is this sort of like, oh, poor Abigail. Like, and that is really yeah. tied to her motherhood in all the versions.
Totally. But then there's this interesting exploration, too, after Ethan cheats on her, where she's like, would he have done that if I had his children? Like, if I was a mother, yeah. would he have cheated on me? That's really interesting, too.
Yeah.
Like, I found that really juicy.
We all know the answer to that. The answer is yes.
Yes. Yes. The narrator says that, yeah. As someone who doesn't have kids, I'm always like, oh, would my partner love me more if I, like, had his children? It's a real question, yeah. So I found it really interesting. Yeah, and I know. It's like, yeah. no. Fathers no. cheat on their wives all the fucking time.
It's beautiful and sad. The thing about children is your partner would love your children.
Right.
As individuals, because that's what they are, is they're people who are separate from you. And like, dads love their kids, but they don't necessarily retain the idea of the kids and the wife being inseparable.
Totally. Yeah. Totally.
Which is good. And then also, you know, it's like, yeah. how'd you think these people got here?
Yep.
I've read some of your Substack essays and stuff about the domestic sphere and motherhood that are brilliant and so gorgeous and awesome.
Thanks.
Was it challenging or like fun to write from what we perceive as a child-free woman?
I don't know if I really thought about her that way. That's just not really like the defining characteristic in my mind. And the other thing I would say is like when you write about motherhood, which I have done it in more explicitly in almost all my other books, is you become a motherhood writer, right? It's one of those things where publishers are just like, if there's a mom in there, they're like, ah, yes.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
The poignant truths of motherhood.
Yes.
And it's frustrating because it's like, we don't, I don't know. It.
Yeah, that's frustrating.
On one hand, it's like, yes, I wrote about that. I'm not going to deny it. But it also, as a marketing category, it turns people off.
Yeah.
Not everyone, obviously. And
yeah.
a lot of people who buy books are mothers. And there's nothing wrong with being a motherhood writer. At the point where I was sitting down to write this book, I was tired of it. And so I think insofar as it felt freeing to not have that centered in the work, I was almost, again, thinking about how other people perceive my work and less about, you know, what I was sitting down to do every day.
Yeah, I guess for me, I also enjoy writing about motherhood, but it forces you to grapple with the stuff that's keeping you up at night. And sometimes I want to break from that. I think why I said Simone felt so aspirational to me at the beginning is because she does have the time and space to devote to her passions that most mothers simply don't.
Yeah, these people have an insane amount of free time.
Yes, yes. And just, I don't know, there were descriptions about, you know, the living, just they don't care about the house being perfectly neat. It's just this very sexy, they just don't have to. And that felt really fun to read.
Yeah. The book is about midlife in a lot of ways. And to some extent, it is a portrait of like what midlife looks like if you don't have a lot of responsibilities. And maybe if you have a very cushy job as an academic at an Ivy League school. And on one hand, like, yeah, they have all this free time. They're like training for marathons. They're lounging around drinking gin in the afternoon and like reading books because it's summer. So the semester hasn't started yet.
Right.
Yeah. And they're playing, you know, mind games with their students and their secretaries. And I think, like, as a person who is adjacent to academia and who, in a lot of ways, has a very privileged, you know, professional life, like, that's all true. That's all real. But it doesn't stop them from having these sort of, like, life-ruining crises.
So this totally.
The crisis, they have a different flavor.
Totally.
Different flavor. So there's a lot in the book about, obviously, using life as fiction and, like, who gets to tell the story. What's your relationship to using your life for fiction? Do you ever find yourself pushing up against uncomfortable boundaries? Or are you like, no, I love using life for fiction? Like, where are you in that whole dialogue?
I find myself with the uncomfortable boundaries. Yeah, the first thing you said.
the boundaries.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard.
Yeah, it's hard.
Emily, this Emily... Emily Smith, did you give a talk recently about like, no, I'm fine. Just here's my real life. Here
totally.
It goes.
My last two like events have been about using life for fiction. And my main character is crazy. And like, it goes off the rails a little, but like the whole foundational character and like setup is very pulled from life. Like I used to work in tech.
Right.
All pulled from life, you know. So I love that. You can feel it sometimes. And as a writer, I just love using something with my actual life. And I know you're like adjacent to academia. And, you know, I was just wondering, because the book is commenting on it directly. So it's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, like right now, if you Google me, the autofill is Emily Adrian Husband. So like I don't...
Really?
I don't love it.
Wow.
Fascinating.
But it's funny because like people have sometimes framed the questions when they're interviewing me as if I wrote autofiction, right? And I didn't because like I didn't go to grad school. I don't have an MFA. I'm not 23. I didn't have any of these sorts of relationships with my professors. But because Robbie is writing autofiction, there's things get collapsed.
Yeah.
Well, and you're a woman, so I feel like...
I know. Yeah. Totally. The thing about women is we can't make things up.
We
have no creativity. Yeah.
We consult the diaries, and then we call it fiction.
100%.
Totally. Yeah.
There's so much space between autofiction and, like, fiction, all caps, you know? And I love the playing around with that space.
Back to just the power dynamics... I just think Simone, yes, she would be respected and revered in academia, regardless of whether or not she was hot. Yes. But for her to be this brilliant and just so intensely fuckable to everyone she encounters is just like, she is this very specific type of ideal woman that I think is not explored that much in fiction.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I was just...
Yeah.
That's not a question, I guess.
No, I know. Half of this interview is just us like showering you with praise. But yeah, the you made me the wife after Ethan cheats.
I don't remember. What's the full context for that?
Okay. It's essentially, I don't know if this is the quote. I just know. It's like the way I interpreted it was like she used to be the main character. And now she's like the cheated on wife. Like, how dare he? And also this... notion that her marriage was this like neat, tidy, like
work of art.
Yeah, like a work of art, essentially. And he tarnished it and
turned it into a cliche, into this cheesy, embarrassing.
Yeah.
It's almost like she's more upset about that.
Right.
Than feeling intrinsically betrayed.
Right.
Yeah,
exactly.
She's upset about the optics and the narrative. Which, you know, it changes the story that they tell themselves and that they tell other people about their marriage. And that, I think, is what, you know, that's the biggest problem for both of them, is that they have to change the story.
Right. No, my comment was like, this line between her being like this egotist, in a sense, caring about perception, versus she's not heartless. She loves Ethan. There is a love there. The other thing I wanted to ask was, it made me think, Sarah, when you were talking about the beauty of Simone again at the end, or a few places in the book, you're like criticizing your own work. You're like talking about the things the thesis instructors like would criticize. Oh, Simone's beauty is like too overdone. What if she was like a more homely character or something?
Right, right.
Or other workshop participants are like criticizing the work. Was
so
that
funny.
Fun for you? Or like, was that a place for you to just take your would-be critics and just roast them kind of like on your own terms? Or was that really hard?
No, it was fun. Yeah. It was fun.
Okay, that's what I thought.
It's so funny, like, how humorless people are. Like, a lot of my, like, Goodreads reviews, which are terrible. People are so angry on the website.
Oh, God.
I hate Goodreads.
And then this book was a book of the month pick, so it brings in this whole, audience.
Yep.
And they did not seem super happy. They are especially critical of those scenes where they're like, I can't believe, like, Emily Adrian thought that she could just tell us that her book was good at the end by having everybody praise Robbie's thesis.
Oh, my God.
I can't.
Oh, my God.
That's God.
Terrible. My friend found it at the airport. Which it's amazing.
The Hudson News picked it as their like book of the month as well. So it ended up at airports.
Oh my gosh.
That's so cool.
That's amazing. Well, it deserves that. Cool. It's so good. So awesome.
Yeah, everybody should read it. We both tore through it. It's just so delicious. That's just the word that keeps coming to me. It's so pleasurable. And I loved it.
On characters, plot and sentence level, I was like stunned. Just so many lines. I was just like, damn. Yeah.
It's also really short.
It is a nice, tasty length. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Emily. This was so fun. And yeah, everybody should read the book. It's so good.
So great chatting with you. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Okay, Sarah, let's do our favorite thing of the week now.
Okay, you go first.
Okay. I've been trying to drink less lately. And I have been obsessing over ginger ale. I forget how much I love ginger ale. I'm bringing it back.
God.
I buy the 2-liter ball. Ben is like, can you not buy like 2-liter balls of soda in our fridge? Because then Charlie's like, I want ginger ale too.
Yep.
And I'm like, no, ginger ale is for M. No, he can have some. But it's been a really... You know, it doesn't hit all the spots, obviously, but it's a really nice treat.
Wow.
And it's been making me happy.
I'm surprised you don't get the cans.
Oh, I do get the cans sometimes, okay. But, you know, on a budget, I just get that 2-liter, fill the glass with some ice.
That's incredible. That's Brett's drink of choice. I don't know if you knew that.
Oh, yeah. You told me that.
Mm-hmm.
Brett
mm-hmm.
and I, we have things in common. I love it. I love it. Okay, how about you?
What is my thing? Oh, I started, basically, I knit occasionally.
She knits.
But it's very stop and start. And like the starting is the hardest part for some reason.
Always, right?
I guess with everything.
Sometimes.
Yeah, totally. And I'm knitting a stocking for a friend's kid. And I had the yarn. It was all set up. And I just wasn't doing it. And I finally started yesterday.
Hell yes. Oh, my God. What a present.
I mean, but it's like also a gift to me
that
because I like doing it.
That just put my whole life to shame. I'm just like, what am I even doing
No. Because it's like my hobby. So I'm looking for projects actively.
I know. That's lovely. Oh, my God. Okay.
So that's
Those
my little
great.
Thing. So I guess I'll see you next
week.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.